When I first met Chris, he was had just moved in Austin, was looking to possibly plant a church. And we had first met, and then we lost contact for several months. And then he soon found his way into our community, has been an active participant in it. And so Chris currently works at Apple. And I think the genius thing, so Chris is also taking some graduate-level courses at Fuller in the Global Leadership Program and has now convinced Steve Jobs to pay for his Global Leadership Program at Fuller. So that's excellent. He's going to be jumping onto the lectionary this morning during the Advent series. And so if you would, give Chris Morton a warm welcome. Do you want me to stick with this?
How's it going, guys? Thank you, Gideon, and thank you guys for having me. My name's Chris, and I'm just a dude. This is the third week of Advent, and, you know, Advent is this season on the church calendar where, you know, we focus on that need that we have and what it feels like to wait for deliverance from despair and from the pains of this world. And this week, I don't know about you guys, I know a lot about the pains of this world from this week because I was moving, and who likes moving? It's the worst thing, that guy. Yeah, thanks. It's the worst thing ever. There was one good thing about it, which is that I got rid of this table that has been this albatross of myself and Daniel, who used to be my roommate. We bought it when we first moved here off of Craigslist. It was in our, you know, price range, and it looked all right. And so we headed over to South Austin and met this lady at her house. And she seemed like a really nice, trustworthy person, right? She worked at a nonprofit clinic, and she had the entire Blu-ray collection of Battlestar Galactica. So, I mean, she has to be a good person, right? And so we look at the table and it looks pretty good, and so, you know, we take it home and I'm making dinner. I'm really excited. I'm in my own apartment. I'm gonna eat on my table, and I sit down and I put my hamburger helper on the table, and I do what Mom always said not to, you know, I put my elbows on the table, and the food kind of slides, and I catch it just before it falls in my lap. And the reason was that this table was completely useless. You know, like, kind of, in my mind at least, like, the definition of a table is, like, four legs and a flat thing on top. And this table did not have four legs. It had a pedestal. And this pedestal, let's see, do we have the picture of the pedestal? Okay, so it's kind of shaped like the letter I there. And it just kind of rolls back and forth. And so we tried everything. We bought braces, and we braced the table, and it still kind of wiggled around there. And so we bought some legs, and we screwed the legs in, and then it just kind of wobbled in all sorts of directions. And eventually, like, it was fun. We'd go out places, and we'd talk to each other separately. We realized that we were both, every time we sat at a table, like, kind of feeling around, seeing how it worked, trying to understand tables. And, you know, eventually we learned you could build an apron on it, and that holds the legs in place. But, you know, we got it finished 3 months later. And to be honest with you, it was ugly and it was uncomfortable. And I think I maybe ate at it three times in the whole time that we lived there. I just wanted nothing to do with it. It was useless. I wanted to be as far away from it as possible. And this morning, we're going to talk about uselessness, not about tools and things like that, but about people. And we're going to look at a really exciting passage of Scripture. We're going to look at a genealogy. This comes from one of the four biographies of Jesus from a book called Matthew. And we're going to go through this list that Matthew gives us of people who, you know, are kind of useless. Matthew is a Jew, and he's talking to his people, and he's trying to tell the story of his people and how Jesus fits into that, right? And so it all starts with a guy named Abraham, and this conversation that Abraham has with God, where God says, I want to bless the whole world, and I want to do that through a nation, and I'm going to use you to do that. Okay, so that's the understanding, bless the whole world through this nation. But now, you know, Matthew's writing this story, and it's a few thousand years later, and in the time between, you know, that's kind of been twisted, and you know, they they ended up hoarding their blessings, keeping them to themselves. They ended up oppressing the nations around them. And by the time this is actually written, that's flipped, and they're living under the oppression of the Roman Empire. And so they have this promise that they're going to be used to bless the whole world, but they feel really useless. And I think a lot of us probably know what it feels like to be useless, right? So like maybe you have a friend or a family member and they're going through a loss and you want to fix it, right? You want to say just the right thing and fix it, and you can't, and you feel useless. Or maybe we had my high school 10-year reunion was this year. I did not go, because you look around at these people and you know they're doing amazing and accomplishing their dreams and moving forward with their life, and you kind of look at yourself, and maybe, or I kind of look at myself, we feel kind of stalled out where we're at, and this isn't where I thought it'd be, and you feel kind of useless. Or maybe we look around East Austin, right? We look around East Austin and we see the pain and the poverty around us, or you look around the world and you see people who don't have access to water, and you see people who don't have access to enough food, and it's overwhelming. We feel like we can't do anything to make a difference there. And the problem with uselessness is it's not something that inspires, right? It's something that actually overwhelms you, and you can't accomplish anything because you're just completely overwhelmed. And that's what this Advent story is. This morning, we're going to look at the people that led up to Jesus, this Advent story, the genealogy that Matthew uses. There's about 40 people here. We're going to look at three of them. And by and large, you know, as you look at them, they seem pretty useless. So let's go ahead and read the text. If you have a Bible or you want to look up on the screen, we're going to look at Matthew chapter 1, verse 1 through 8. And just go ahead and read that with your neighbors there. Okay. Yeah, so that's pretty exciting, right? Cool stuff. Okay, so let's start up at the top. Abraham is the father of Isaac, and Isaac is the father of Jacob, right? Okay, Jacob, from literally, like, from the moment he is born, is set up to be a failure, okay? So he lives in this culture where the firstborn is given just all of these rights and responsibilities. They're set up to be a leader from a young age, and they are going to receive the lion's share of the inheritance from their father, and Jacob is the second of twins. So literally, he shows up a couple of minutes too late, and he's set up for failure from the beginning. Okay, add to that Jacob's brother Esau, like, he was born for his moment in history. He is the perfect hunter-gatherer, right? So he comes out of the womb, and he's got this, like, big head of red hair and already has, like, you know, some muscle tone as a child. And, you know, so he grows up, and he hunts with his bare hands, you know, and he arm wrestles, and he plays football, and he's been shaving since he was 8 years old. That's Jacob's brother, Esau. Jacob, well, he hangs out in the tent with mom and plays with the animals and takes care of the sheep and, you know, maybe reads poetry. But he's not exactly what they're looking for in a hunter-gatherer society. And what happens is that Isaac loves his son Esau a lot more than Jacob, just from the beginning. He's a failure as a man. Jacob does what you do when kind of the cards are stacked against you. You learn to take care of yourself, generally at the expense of other people. So Jacob becomes a con man. There's one story about him conning his brother who was hungry and tricking him. And there's a really awful story about him actually pulling a con on his father, who's now blind and in his deathbed, right? And so now Jacob's pulled this off, but it makes his brother so mad that he has to run for his life, and he lives in exile for 14 years. Okay, so he's a failure as a son. And he goes and he lives in exile, and he kind of gets his life together. He ends up having a family of his own. He actually has 12 boys, and one of those boys he just loves, is his favorite, and he dotes on him like crazy. You would have thought that he would know better from his experience, but no, he just lavishes his love on one child, and the brothers respond by hating the father's favorite son, and they actually fake his death and sell him into slavery, and then they lie to their dad about it, right? So now Jacob is a failure as a father. I mean, you look at Jacob any time in his life, and he is a total failure. I don't know about you guys. I have had a lot of opportunities to learn about being failure. Recently, okay, so I moved to Austin from San Antonio, and I wanted to, I was going to be a part of this nonprofit, and they do this thing basically where they provide housing for you, and in exchange, you throw parties for your neighbors. Sounds like a pretty sweet gig, right? So, actually was on the waiting list for about a year, got into this apartment, and we move in. Our job was to do 3 events a month. And so just an idea of what that looks like, okay? So we have to plan the month out. That takes a couple hours. Then we have to plan the event. So it was March, and we were going to do a St. Patrick's Day potato bar, right? Because Irish people and potatoes. And so we're going to have St. Patrick's Day potato bar. So we plan this party, and we make flyers and send out Facebook invitations, and that's a couple hours. And then we buy 60 potatoes, and we clean the 60 potatoes, and we cover them in oil, and we cover them in foil, and we cook them, and that takes about 4, 5, 6 hours right there. And then we go buy decorations, and we put the decorations up, and that takes a couple of hours. And then 6 people come. We've now put in 18 hours-ish of work, and it's to feed 6 people baked potatoes, which is cool. I mean, I'm glad they got to eat baked potatoes. I got to eat baked potatoes for the next 3 months, hash browns for breakfast and fries for lunch and dinner. For 3 months as we tried to get rid of these. You know, we had some good times. Not all of our events were that dismal of a failure. But, you know, after a few months of that, the apartment said, you know, maybe it's not going to work out. It's not us, it's you. And they asked us to leave. So that's why I was moving this week. I really know what Jacob is feeling like, to feel like a failure. And maybe some of you guys have felt like a failure. Maybe, you know, school was never your thing, and that was really hard growing up. Or maybe you've dealt with an addiction, and you can't just kick it, and you feel like a failure because of that. Maybe some of us, we're estranged from our families, like Jacob was. Or maybe maybe anybody been dumped before or divorced and you feel like a failure. I was unemployed for about a year. Anybody been unemployed and you just send out resumes to the ether and then nothing I can't think of anything that makes me feel like more of a failure than that. I was talking to Gid about this, and he said that every parent feels like a terrible parent at some point. I don't know about this, but I can't imagine. I mean, Gid seems like a cool guy, but every parent feels like a terrible parent, feels like a failure at some point. And, you know, we look at this story of Jacob, and he's just such a failure. But it's amazing, you know, that that's a part of Advent, because that means Advent's all about failure. And I think we need failure, right? We can't experience Advent without failure. Without failure, there's no longing. There's no desire, no hope that the world could be a better place, that I could get my life together, that the world could be healed of its pains. And so without failure, there's no longing, and we need that. So Jacob seems so useless, but his uselessness actually helps us to understand what the world really could be and should be. And so Matthew starts his story off, his Advent list of people, with Jacob. And let's go down a few more here. We got Isaac, the father of Jacob, Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers, Judah, the father of Perez, and you skip down a few generations here. You get to Salmon, not the fish, the dude who was the father of Boaz, and his mother was Rahab, and Salmon and Rahab have a baby named Boaz. Boaz is the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Okay, let's talk about Ruth for a minute. To understand Ruth, you have to understand a little bit about her family. Okay, so there's this dude, he is a father. His name is Elimelech, and Elimelech is a father and a husband. He has a wife named Naomi, and the country they live in is going through a famine. Okay, so let's say that Elimelech and Naomi and the boys, they live in Texas, right? And so because there's a famine in Texas, All the oil dries out, and they move to Canada, you know, trying to start a new life. And they pick up and move the boys to Canada, and they sell everything in Texas, and they buy a house, and Elimelech gets a good job, and Naomi is just the perfect little wife, and she takes care of the boys and takes them to school and soccer practice, and Elimelech, you know, brings home the bacon, and they have this really great life for like 10 years, and the boys grow up, and they marry these local Canadian girls, and they have a Canadian wedding, and then one night, Elimelech, you know, he's got a little heartburn, feeling a little feverish, and he heads to bed early, and he doesn't wake up the next morning. And you have Naomi and her two boys and their wives, and they're just devastated, and they begin this mourning process. And then a couple of weeks later, the boys get sick, and they pass away. And now you have three women who are widows, and just the devastation of one loss after another. And so Naomi kind of takes stock, and she realizes, I'm not a Canadian. And so she decides to move back to Texas. And she tells the girls, she says, I love you, you're great daughters-in-law, but go home to your families. And one of them leaves, but the other, Ruth, says, no, I'm going to stick with you no matter what. So the two ladies travel from the Great White North back to Texas. And but the problem is Naomi's been gone a really long time. And, you know, people have moved on and people have passed away, and Naomi's old herself and she can't really take care of herself. And so that means that taking care of both of them falls to Ruth. But there's a problem with that, which is that Ruth has the deck stacked against her. She is a woman in a culture that doesn't respect women, right? So she's not going to go out and get a job. She's not going to be able to just start her own business. So she can't support them that way. And then she's a Canadian, and, you know, Texans are very, you know, mistrustful, right, of foreigners, and those Canadians with their hockey and maple syrup and not sure that they can trust her. So she's just kind of got that baggage with her where she goes. And then on top of that, she's a widow, right? And so it's not like some nice Texas boy just is waiting to sweep her off her feet because she's damaged goods in that culture, right? So here we have Ruth, and she's been relegated by her culture. She's, you know, she's obviously a loving person and a great person, but culture has relegated her to this place of uselessness, right? She can't get a job. She can't, you know, do anything, and kind of forced out there to the outskirts to being an outsider. And there was a story recently in Chinese newspapers about an outsider named Ah Long. He's a six-year-old boy. Can we bring up a picture of Ah Long? There he is. Six-year-old boy, so think like Noah, if you know Noah. And his parents both died of AIDS. And so now Ah Long he also has a disease. And his school will not allow him to come to school. He has an extended family, but the extended family is not interested in taking care of him. And they do have social services there, but because of the whole weird family mix-up, social services isn't willing to put him up for fostering or adoption. And so 6 years old, Ah Long lives in the house that belonged to his parents. He has a couple of chickens and a dog, and he washes his own clothes, and he cleans the house, and he makes his own meals at 6 years old, takes care of himself, probably cooking some eggs up there from the chickens. And he's just a kid, but society has decided he's going to be an outsider, right? They've relegated him to the edge, made him an outsider. And Advent is a time for outsiders. It is a time full of stories of outsiders. You know, Jesus was an outsider, right? There's this story of Jesus where he's out preaching and his mom and his brothers come to see him. And you're like, oh, great, I got a little smiling face in the audience, going to be so encouraged. And then after his sermon, they kind of pull him aside and they say, Jesus, you need to stop the crazy talk and you need to come back to the carpentry shop and hang out with us in Nazareth. You can't keep doing this. And, you know, they've looked at the choices he's made and who he's become. And in his own family, Jesus was an outsider. And some of us, maybe we can relate, right? Maybe we've made some decisions or have a lifestyle and our own family, you know, the one place in society where you really hope you can count on them to include you. You know, we've been forced to the outskirts. Or maybe some of us actually being here at Vox is a really hard thing. Maybe being at a church is a really hard thing, and maybe some of us feel like we're outsiders even here because, you know, we've got a history, and we've got things that we believe, and maybe we don't believe, or we don't know what we believe, or we don't want people to know what we believe or don't believe, and we fear that if anyone knew that we wouldn't be welcome, right? If they really knew who I was, we wouldn't be welcome. And I just want to press pause button on this whole thing for a second. And I want to assure you, like, whoever you are, like, wherever you've came from, whatever stuff you're working through, wrestling with, Vox is a safe place to do that, right? I want you guys to know, Vox is a safe place to do that. I mean, just look around this room. This is a church full of outsiders. We're all outsiders here in one way or another. And whatever you're wrestling with, like, come here, join in, settle in, you know, have some coffee and get to know each other. And it's okay. I mean, you don't have to have it all together and know exactly, or you don't have to agree with what you hear, but you are welcome to be a part of it. But Advent is kind of our story in that way, a story of outsiders. And that raises a question, which is, you know, if we are a people of outsiders and Advent is a story of outsiders, what does that mean for us as far as our responsibility, right? Like, what is our responsibility to each other and for the outsiders within us? And what is our responsibility to our city, to the people around us and the outsiders there? And, you know, the problem with outsiders is that culture pushes you to the edge, and like Ruth was pushed to the edge and made to feel useless, and made to feel like an outsider. You know, so the list goes on, and what's incredible is Ruth actually ends up becoming the grandmother of a guy named King David, and King David, his sons end up being this long line of kings. And so you go on, you know, so Boaz is the father of Obed, Obed the father of Jesse, Jesse the father of David. You skip down a few generations, you get down to Ahaz, the father of Hezekiah, and Hezekiah is the father of Manasseh. Now, to understand Manasseh, you have to put that in the context of who Hezekiah was. Okay, so if David is the perfect king and everything that you would want in a king, like Hezekiah, probably like top two or top three, okay? Like stellar, really incredible king, and he did a great job of bringing the focus of his people onto God and helping them worship God, and the country did pretty well under Hezekiah. But then Hezekiah dies, and at 12 years old, Manasseh is put in charge of this entire kingdom. And for some reason, maybe Manasseh was a rebel, or maybe he was just 12 years old and didn't know any better. But Manasseh looks around and he says, cool, we've got one God that we worship, and that's good. But if you look around, you know, our neighbors, they've got a God they worship, and our other neighbors, they've got a different God they worship. And the more the merrier, right? So he started importing these foreign gods into the culture of Israel. And the problem with that is when you look at the way that these foreign gods were worshipped, it's actually pretty horrifying. I'll give you an example, one of many. Let's say, okay, so agrarian culture, everything is reliant on the harvest, right, and what you can eat. And so harvest isn't going too well. So you, one night, you go to the nursery, and you grab a baby, and you meet up with the priests of the foreign gods, and you head out of the city to this valley, and this valley has been used as a garbage dump for the last couple of decades, and so all this decomposing trash, and it creates methane, and the methane catches on fire, so you've got this valley just full of trash and smoke, right? and you're out there with the baby and the priests, and the priests call on their foreign god, and they say, you know, if we sacrifice this to you, then you'll give us a great harvest. And they pray for that, and then Manasseh takes his baby, and he burns his baby alive. He burns the baby. Now, as goes a leadership, so goes the country, right? And the crazy thing is that Manasseh actually was a trendsetter, and burning babies became really chic in his country, and so everybody's doing it, and everybody is burning these children alive. And the text actually says that underneath Manasseh, they did more evil than any of the countries that came before them, right? Any of the ones you would compare him to, it was worse under Manasseh. And it's hard to get our minds around what a monster Manasseh really was. We've had some bad guys over the last couple of decades, right? You know, we've had Hitler and Stalin. And one that's in the news lately, if we can go ahead and grab this, one that's in the news lately has been Kim Jong-il. And I don't know if you guys have seen this blog called Kim Jong-il Looking at Things. And pictures of the great leader looking at things. Here he is. Let's see. Looking at a boat. Let's keep going. Looking at this guy. Keep going. Looking at the sky. Keep going. Here he is looking at wallpaper. What else we got? Looking at pigs. Yeah. This is my favorite. Looking in from the kitchen cabinet. What else we got? Let's do a couple more. Oh, yes, looking at a radish. That's the best one. Yeah. So it seems harmless enough, right? Poofy hair, funny hats, big old glasses. Yeah, I mean, you can't take that guy too seriously. So we've hosted a few movies from Liberty in North Korea here at Vox. And if you wanna know some more about this, I would suggest there's a really good talk that was given by Adrian Hong of Liberty in North Korea at Google Tech Talks. You can find it if you search in YouTube for Human Rights in North Korea. And so here's some of the stats that he mentioned. Okay, so in North Korea, you have this absolute totalitarian state based on this kind of hero worship of Kim Jong-il. And because it's totalitarian, they can limit access to everything. So they limit the access to the food. The average ration of food is about 250 grams a day. That means there are 13 million people living in malnutrition. Now, what malnutrition does is that it stunts your growth. And so the average 7-year-old in North Korea is 3.5 feet tall, whereas the average 7-year-old in South Korea, so they've got the same genetic background, right? The average 7-year-old in South Korea is a little over 4 feet tall. Okay, so the average adult in North Korea grows to be about 5 feet tall. So it's very visible result of what's going on there. There's no health infrastructure, no access to hospitals, and what that means is like very treatable diseases just run rampant. You have tuberculosis and typhoid fever and things like that. You know, no freedom of communication or media or movement or religion. There are 10 concentration camps that we know of, and there's somewhere between 200,000 and 250,000 prisoners in these concentration camps. There's about a 1 in 4 chance if you end up at one of these concentration camps that you will die there. And when you look at this, what's wild about it is in the meantime, Kim Jong-il is just living this wild, over-the-top lifestyle. I mean, it's not just that he's looking at radishes. There was a period in the 90s that he was the world's single largest purchaser of Hennessy. He, over a few years, purchased between $600,000 and $850,000 worth of Hennessy cognac. Okay, that means in a country where the average person lives off of about $1,000 a year, he was spending $800,000 that year on one type of alcohol. Let's see, what else? He's got about 14 palaces. That's one thing that they know. Owns about 20,000 movies. One newspaper reported, one time he kidnapped a director from South Korea so they could make like a Godzilla sequel. One newspaper reported that he's got $4 billion in offshore accounts. So if he ever has to leave North Korea, he's got that money there waiting for him. And, you know, we hear this and we think, yeah, but I mean, that doesn't mean anything to me. I mean, I don't burn babies, right? You know, I don't oppress nations. But let's think about it for a second. And I know this sounds obvious, but what's wrong with burning a baby? Okay, and it's not that they're cute and innocent and haven't done anything wrong. That's all true. But what's wrong with it is you are forcing your will on this child, and you are gaining at their expense, right? Like Manasseh is gaining the favor of the foreign gods by sacrificing this child. He's gaining at their expense. And Kim Jong-il is able to buy lots of Hennessy at the expense of the Korean people. And, you know, I think this is something that maybe we ought to wrestle with as Americans, right? So, you know, on the church calendar, this is Advent, but, you know, in the American economic calendar, this is that crazy time between Black Friday and Christmas where Americans just go crazy and spend more money than they do the rest of the year combined, and all the companies finally break even. I work in retail, and it's just insane, people showing up at 4 a.m., slamming on the door, wanting something. And I don't know that we really think about it, right? Okay, so, like, you go and you see this great sale on some ugly tie, and you're like, this ugly tie will look great on Grandpa, you know, but you don't say, I wonder where this ugly tie came from, and I wonder who sewed it, and I wonder what kind of living conditions they were under, you know. Or you get a cool new gadget, and you don't, you say, awesome, now I can, you know, play Angry Birds wherever I go. And we don't say, I wonder where the components were made for it. Like, I wonder if slave labor in the Congo was required to make the components of this. You know, we don't ask these questions. We're just one, okay, how can I spend money? How can I get the gift I want? How can I gain? And we as a country need to ask this question, like, what are we gaining? And at what expense are others suffering for our gain? Something we need to wrestle with at Advent. Maybe it's a little more personal. Like, some of us really want the perfect Christmas, right? And we really, really work to create this perfect Christmas. And so we've got to get everybody in town, and we've got to get the decorations just right, and we've got to get the Christmas cards sent out, and we've got to cook just the right meal and have it made just right and smells really good, and, you know, have this idea in our heads that maybe we learned from a movie somewhere of this perfect Christmas. And we work really hard to do it, and we force everyone around us to bend to our will. Like, you will show up here, and you will, you know, be a part of this. You will sing Christmas carols with us. And we will, you know, this idea of, and we're kind of forcing our will on other people so that we can have this perfect Christmas. And it's something we need to think about. I mean, what are we gaining, and why are we gaining? And, you know, who has the sacrifice for our gain? And this, nothing could be more opposite than Jesus, right? I mean, isn't that the entire story of Jesus, that his sacrifice was our gain, that his expense was our gain? So we have these people. We have Manasseh. He's a monster. And as a monster, taking advantage of his people, instead of being a useful king who leads them well, he's useless. And then we have Ruth, who is forced to the outskirts. She's forced to be an outsider. Instead of being, you know, a part of society, she's forced to be useless. And we have Jacob, who fails time and time again, and he just becomes useless. And so the question is like, what kind of story is this, right? Like, why would you go to all this effort and list these 40 names just to show us a bunch of useless stories? So maybe it's, well, it's might be a little like this. I have a friend, and her name is Jessica, and she's a grad student here at UT, but she also has a nonprofit called the Hill Country Hill Tribers. And there is a lot of persecution going on in Burma, and there are these Burmese refugees that have come to live in Austin to escape that. And, you know, if you've ever been around refugees, maybe you read the book What is the What, and you kind of have an idea, but it's really hard to get started as a refugee in our country. And and so you have the skill set that worked in your country but maybe not here. And so what she does is she gets the women together, and they sew these really cool looking bags. Here's one that probably take about 20 hours worth of work on a loom, which is pretty cool. But those are really hard to produce. So what she did, let's go a slide here. Okay, so when you ship rice, right, and we ship rice so we can have it, you know, with our vegetables or whatever, they ship in these bags here that really are good for that one thing. You ship the rice in it, you cut it apart, you throw it in the trash, and it's never used again. Or coffee, you know, coffee is shipped in these really thick, heavy burlap bags that are good for getting the coffee from, you know, wherever in South America or Africa and getting it here to Starbucks. And, you know, and so the burlap is used once and then thrown away. And you just have these scraps. They're not as strong as they were originally. And so what they do is they take these used rice bags and they make them into these really cool little totes, little grocery bags. Here's one made out of burlap, which I just think this is the coolest thing. If I carried a purse, this would be it. You know, it makes a good purse, makes a good, you know, messenger bag if you're a dude, you know. And, yeah, so you've got these pieces of trash, really, right? I mean, useless, torn-up burlap. It served its purpose. It's going in the trash. But it's, you take these scraps together and you sew them together. You make something really beautiful out of it, something really useful. And that's what this genealogy is all about, right? You look at these stories of uselessness, but when you get to the end of it, you see that it's all been brought together so that Jesus could come, and that God is sewing these useless lives together to make something really useful. And that's our hope here at Vox, too, that our lives and those of us who feel useless can be brought together to create something beautiful for Austin and for our world.